Our next speaker is Lance Christensen. He lives in Golden, Colorado, and operates a home recording and archiving studio, DWD Productions. His collection of cylinders and 78s largely focuses on band and dance music. He's a digital and audio archivist with the Colorado State Archives and is a professional musician and audio engineer. Please join me in welcoming Lance.
Be just a moment to get this set up, and then we'll be good to go. I think the plug's on this side. There we go. Hello. Something just happened. There we go. Oh, isn't that pretty? All right, thank you very much. Once again, my name is Lance Christensen. Most of my work that I do at the Colorado State Archives involves spoken material, but over the years I've in Denver worked with a number of recordings, mostly dealing with restoring oral histories and that sort of thing for local societies, but then I've also gotten into cylinder and disc work. And what I'm going to talk about today is basically an experiment. This is an experiment on the archiving of cylinder records, which for most audio preservationists, you usually focus on the best reproduction and recording processes. And since the playback of these historic artifacts creates wear on the original recording, the ability to reproduce these recordings without further playback has been a primary concern. But really what this is about is not so much archiving, but about interpretation. And what I've done here is to examine an approach to acoustic and electronic reproduction of cylinders. When I say acoustic, I'm referring to the playback mechanism. Acoustic playback, electronic, referring to using a cartridge to play these cylinders. And because really this is about the art, and that's why I called this up. And it sounds great.
Degree of mechanical skill. My voice is the clearest, smoothest, and most natural of any talking machine. The name of my famous master is on my body and tells you that I am a genuine Edison phonograph.
So basically what's going to happen here is I'm not going to encourage anybody to get rid of their archaeophones at this time. Although if any of you choose to do so, please come talk to me. I'm sure we can work something out. But what I've done here is to work with three methods for creating basically a new recording. The first method is purely acoustic, which involves using a large reproducing horn, a good recording microphone in a fairly neutral environment. The second is to eliminate the horn entirely and to actually use a microphone placed in very close proximity to the reproducer and the diaphragm in it. And then the last method is to use a standard electronic pickup that reads directly off of the record using a modern phono stylus. So to do this experiment, I wanted to have a fairly simple set of criteria for the records. So first thing I did was to eliminate brown wax records and home recorded records. The quality on those is fairly inconsistent compared with later recordings, and the pantographic methods used on a lot of the brown wax records creates its own set of distortion that I didn't want to particularly deal with. I also eliminated blue Ambrol cylinders after 1914 because of the direct dubbing that they did from the diamond discs, which once again introduces some artifacts that I didn't want to deal with. So the 11 cylinders I selected for this particular experiment were taken from Columbia and Edison wax cylinders after about 1904, indestructible 2-minute records up to 1918, Edison 4-minute wax Ambrol cylinders, and then finally the blue Ambrol and indestructible 4-minute records, just to get a nice breadth of the material there. You're not going to hear all of these today, obviously, but that was the criteria I used. This is the actual list of the records that I used. most in at least very good condition. Just tried to select records that were more or less in the same sorts of conditions for use in this, so you can get some idea of what they would sound like in all of these. So for the purely acoustic reproduction, what I did was to select first a large standard horn. In this case, it's a large aftermarket horn that was manufactured at the time. It's basically a witch's hat horn on steroids, about so big. The two machines I used for this were an Edison Model B home phonograph with a 2 and 4 minute mechanism on it, and then an Amberola DX. And the reason the Amberola was used is the Model H reproducer just introduces it doesn't handle the celluloid cylinders real well. It just gets a little bit too excited by those. So the three reproducers used, obviously, would be the Model C for the 2 minute records, the Model H for the wax 4 minute, and then the Diamond B is on the Amberola. I used a ribbon microphone for the recording on this. I've tried many microphones over the years with both these machines and with musical instruments, which in a lot of ways this represents. It's a large horn. It has its own formants and qualities to it. And the ribbon microphone in this case, it's called the Victor. It has a 2 7/16 inch aluminum ribbon. It's very flat and has a very nice open sound, and it tends to reject a lot of the really sharp sounds that you get with some condenser microphones. The recording space was a fairly small space with curtains placed at either side to reduce reflection. And then this, like all of the recordings you're going to hear, were recorded digitally. The original masters recorded it at 24-bit, 96 kilohertz, and then stepped down for editing for this presentation. So this is what the home phonograph looked like. You can see the microphone in front of it. That placement was based on experimentation to maximize sound and minimize the sound of the machine itself. With the Amberola, it's a slightly different setup, but not that much different. And of course, during playback, that lid was down on there. This was the actual recording equipment that was used, the Olympus LS-10 being the input for the actual recording. You'll notice on the ribbon mic, I did have to use a 20 decibel amplifier on it just to step it up to being used. So here's a few examples of how that turned out. First one here, this is Edison 9660 Arthur Collins. Oops, go back. I got a little too excited there. Come back, mouse. Come back, mouse. I've decided everything works here until someone gets up here to do a PowerPoint. I can't find my mouse. There it is. Be nice to it.
There's always something wrong. It's always something wrong most all the time. I find out right along that all the calculating ain't worth a dime. It's a case of...
So not any real strong bursts of sound out. It's a fairly flat sound. Moving over to Mr. John Philip Sousa in a 1909 wax recording. And then finally moving to a Blue Amberol recording from 1913, Ferdinand Himmelreich. This is Variations on Annie Laurie, and there goes my mouse again. Get back there. So my observations from this, of course, the physical location of the microphone has a great influence on what kind of playback you get. Over time, there is noticeable machine noise. It's outside the spectrum of the recording. You do notice this on all the recordings. And also some noise from the diaphragm. The diaphragm will react on certain pitches and will create its own set of noises. It does work best on band records, but even the soft records seem to work well. Did notice on some of the spoken word and the piano recordings that the microphone did have to be moved a little bit closer to get the optimum playback on that. Now for using the mic without the horn, in this case it was an Audio-Technica Pro 35, and if any of you have ever seen that particular microphone, it's on a clip. It's a kind of a kind of a curve-shaped thing. It's meant to clip on the bell of an inch of a horn or a saxophone or something along those lines. And it's a good microphone for that kind of close, high-intensity sound. And for the purpose of this, I removed the clip and then inserted it directly into the diaphragm by using the rubber hose that's the connector for the horn. I found if you put it actually into the throat of the diaphragm, you picked up more rumble from the machine than was very optimal. Same two machines were used for this, same reproducers. I did do some EQ shelving on this. It was a little bit dramatic. It's a 320 down to 80. If I was to do this over time, I'd probably reduce that. And the main reason is this microphone has a very strong bass response to it, and which is optimal in a lot of cases. But in the particular case of this, it created so many bass artifacts that the recording was basically unlistenable, and this seemed to take care of it. There's not a lot of frequency response to the records below that, so it seemed like a good compromise. Once again, recorded digitally. So that's a close-up of the setup there, both on the home phonograph and on the Ambarola. The microphone's actually placed about two-thirds of the way down that tube. So here's some of the same examples here. You heard this one earlier.
There's always something wrong. There's always something wrong. Most
slightly
all the
cleaner.
Time. I find out right along that all the calculating ain't worth a dime.
This is a Columbia cylinder, just
to give you an example. Overture to poet and peasant, played by Gilmore's band, Columbia Records.
One thing you will notice with these transfers, there, despite the roll-off, there is a bit more bass response. You hear the tubas a little more clearly on these. With this one particularly, this is an indestructible cylinder, and do listen for the low end on this one. And then finally, that same piano recording from the Blue Ambarola. Noticeable increase in the bass on that. So once again, we're still hearing machine noise with this. We've eliminated the horn overtones to a certain extent and increased the bass despite the roll-off on that. That last one, you do notice there is more noise on the Ambarola, and I think that's probably basically the construction of the mechanism. You've got the fireside engine in there. It's sitting a little bit closer to the frame, so there's just a little bit more noise inherent in that particular machine. Finally, for the electronic reproduction, for those of you who heard the talk I did at the last ARS convention or read the paper in this month's journal, what I used for this is the Edisonia or ACT2 reproducer. Rob Lomas sold this to me a number of years ago, and it's made to fit into a standard Edison carriage. Uses a Stanton 500 cartridge with a number of styluses. Expert makes those. For this, of course, I only use the home phonograph because that's the only one that's the only one that fits in. The styluses I used, I don't have a great selection of them, but essentially it was a 6 mm stylus on the 2 minute records, 4 mm for the wax 4 minute records, and then a 2.7 diamond stylus for the Blue Ambarolas. This was, in a lot of ways, it wasn't optimal. I'd like to have more styluses, particularly the 1918 Indestructible that I'm not playing here. None of those styluses worked particularly well on it. The grooves were just a little bit different on that. I'm not going to go into the flat preamp. We've already heard about that. And then this one was recorded directly to my computer, so just because of proximity, that was easier. I could have used the portable recorder, but in this case, I chose not to. So that's what it looks like. You can see the stylus mounted in there, and then here it is in place on the machine. It's a stereo output that's summed by a Y into the mixing board, and that cancels out the horizontal frequencies. That was what was recommended. It seems to work quite well. You'll hear quite a difference in these.
Yeah, there's always something wrong. It's always something wrong most all the time.
A lot more high frequency.
Find out right along that all my calculating ain't worth a dime.
Overture to Poet and Peasant, played by Gilmore's band, Columbia Records.
It's an interesting echoing now. Here's that same indestructible record. And then finally the piano recording. Obviously, this process is the one that's least damaging to the records. The stylus tracks at approximately 5 grams, give or take, compared to 30 grams or more on the original acoustic reproducers. The reproduction is fairly crisp on these, with a slightly wider frequency response. You do hear a lot more surface noise on the records, obviously, and you also hear more of the faults on the record. In comparing all the samples, I notice you hear some of the pops and cracks that weren't obvious in the acoustic playback are very obvious in the electronic playback. Also, any imperfections in the record surface, any bumps, any warps, those become a lot more obvious with this sort of playback. So in looking at the, this is actually a noise analyzer, but in looking at the graph on this, the red line is actually the more relevant one here. But that's on the acoustic playback. You'll notice that it drops off pretty dramatically down around 200 hertz. And then at the top, it starts rolling off at 2,000 and just goes pretty much straight down. So a very narrow window that's in. When you look at it with the microphone closer to the diaphragm, despite the roll-off that I put in with the bass, you see a bump there that I think if I contoured that a little bit more, it'd be probably a little bit more gradual. But you can definitely see the increased bass response. The high-frequency response isn't that much different. But then when you look at the electronic, you see the increased response in the higher end and a more gradual response in the low end. But there you see a lot more of that information happening in the 5,000 to 10,000 and above range. This wasn't as dramatic a difference as I thought I would see. I was a little bit surprised, but that's probably, I think that's the records, those are the records themselves. These were all samples of the same segment of a record. And that's probably consistent with the frequency response in these recordings. So here's a couple examples that I want to finish up with here. And these are, what I've done with these is I've tied them together so you hear the transition from the acoustic to the microphone within the reproducer and then finally to the electronic reproduction. So this first one, I find this one kind of interesting. This is a 1908 recording, William Howard Taft, and on an Edison 10005. And there's my mouse. And so it's going to start first with just the reproduction with the horn. And you'll hear it transition as it plays.
Its advocates seem to suppose that this change in some way will inure only to the benefit of the poor working man. As a matter of fact, the person who will secure chief advantage from it is the wealthy and unscrupulous defendant, able to employ astute and cunning counsel and anxious to avoid justice. The maintenance of the authority of the courts is essential unless we are prepared to embrace anarchy. Never in the history of the country has there been such an insidious attack upon the judicial system as the proposal to interject a jury trial between all orders of the court made after full hearing and the enforcement of such orders.
Fairly dramatic difference between all three of those. This one, not quite so dramatic, at least in terms between the horn recording and the non-horn recording. It's still a slight difference, but I think it's probably because of the volume of this particular recording. This is Edison Amberall number 30. and so mandolin and guitar. Last example on here, this is from Blue Amberol 1642. This is a scripture lesson, organ scripture lesson, and then the Edison Mixed Quartet singing. And once again, the same progression. So basically, the whole point of this was to just compare these playbacks and see what different responses we could get. The question sometimes is asked, what is the true reproduction? The engineers at that time arguably were recording for the machines they were being played on. It can also be argued that they were recording more information on the records than can be than they could reproduce at that time. So once again, this is not an archival suggestion. It's just basically an examination of different playback materials. So I'll take questions. Yes, sir.
What preamp
do
you use for the electronic production?
The preamp I used was a. I got it through a DC art. It's an ST1200. It's a battery driven mechanism.
And it's flat. It really is flat. It's
as flat as I've found without going into the $500 range. That could be my mechanism. I'm not going to claim anything's 100% flat on those. But yeah, you're right. It might be rolled off just a little bit. Yes, sir.
My ARSC experience has come full circle now. Back in 1972, I believe it was, this was my second convention, Bob Carneal of the Library of Congress gave a talk about how he decided at LC to record the ethnomusicological cylinders they had there. Because now they're looking for several different things. They're looking for intelligibility, and they're looking for being able to pull out individual instruments, pulling out individual voices. And they decided to do their recording three different ways. With a microphone in front of the horn, with a microphone deep into the horn, and electrically, and that all three versions are there for the listener to pick and choose and decide because different things would come out in different cylinders for different purposes, and these are all, of course, individually recorded, not professionally recorded, cylinders with all sorts of different characteristics of the instrumentation and everything. And you know, you have done this with now being able to show us visually also what we're hearing. But you did the exact same three methods that Bob Carneal did in the early 1970s.
Well, this isn't a defense, but I was 11. And it would be about 5 years before I collected my first records, but. I guess it just goes to show there's no such thing as a true approach to anything. But that's really cool that they came up with that, because it made sense to me. So obviously it made sense to somebody else too.
Yeah, and in some cases, he played us examples where in some cases one method and the second method or the third method, and sometimes you would hear something in one you didn't hear in the other. On the three that you played at the end, the first and third one, I'd pick the electrical one. The second one, I would pick the Castilian one, mm-hmm. The microphone deep, right at the reproducer.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, and this is not But I do submit that in order to play vertically cut grooves, especially wide vertically cut grooves, you need to use an elliptical stylus.
What?
An elliptical stylus.
He's saying to use an elliptical stylus for playing the wide grooves of a vertically cut record.
And the wider, you know, it just makes the more sense. And somebody that's more technically oriented than I am, is it tracing distortion? You're skating across the bottom of the groove on high frequencies, and you're basically squaring off the wave.
When you start tracking.
That's right. You're not tracking the groove.
In fact, Bill Clinger can address that. When you wrote your paper, you were talking about the way, you know, with the bolt that, with the button ball 2-minute stylus and the 4-minute stylus, that the actual contact from the standpoint of the waveform was the same, 8 mils, I think it was. And you can't, you calculated the cutoff frequency, they can track it around 4K.
Yeah, the best match for playback will always be a stylus that has exactly the same shape and size as the cutting stylus. And the cutting stylus had a 40 mil diameter, 20 mil radius.
Wow.
You can see how much larger that is than the 6 that we use.
Yes, certainly.
2 minutes. But it's difficult to make a modern stylus. So Wyndham Hodgson can't do it in diamond because it's too big. It's
That's
too
right.
Costly. And it'll bottom out the cantilever, the elastomer that's in his cartridges can't handle that large a weight. So it's problematic.
Well, and it is once again, you're dealing with something that, at least in 1906 standards, your reproducer is a highly machined article, but it's not going to approach anything that they had, you know, late in later years with microgroove technology. And that's kind of the trade-off that you have there. And I find it interesting that something that hasn't been addressed a whole lot, and where they're just going to sidestep the whole thing by not using a stylus at all and using lasers and other things. So that's a good point. Yes, sir.
Would you comment on how you prepared each of the reproducers that you used?
These reproducers, I've rebuilt both of them recently. And so it was just the best adjustments that I could do. I'm by no means an expert on that, but both of them were in need of it in time for this. And the other side of that, too, is realizing that as I got to the end of the experiment, my home phonograph needs adjusting, too. So it's when dealing with the mechanical issues, that's sometimes what you run into. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And you hear that actually more with the Amberola than you do with the home. Right, which is what I said. If someone's selling their Archaeophone,
so you're not ruling out that. That's not part of your.
No, I'm not. I'm acknowledging the machine noise in all of the recordings, and you do notice quite a bit of rumble in the microphone in the reproducer. And that's largely through that. In a perfect world, I would either use a modern electronic machine, or do what Glenn Sage has done up in Washington, where he's tied a servo-controlled motor to the mechanism, which is eliminating a lot of that vibration and such that you get from the spring and from the motor and from the, you know, from all the mechanism that's inside. Yes, sir. Yes.
Would be possibly, if I recall correctly, the Pro 35 is a cardioid microphone. You may want to
that
use
is correct.
An Omni microphone that would then get rid of the proximity effect that you get, which is why you get so much muffle.
That would make sense, yeah. And there aren't too many that are, I mean, at least not many that are made with that kind of capsule that can just slide in there.
Well, Crown makes some good, very tiny
Yeah. I mean, what I was really trying to do there was avoid a lavalier mic, which has its own issues when it comes to proximity, as you can tell. But that's a great idea. Yeah. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.
One last thanks to both Doug and to Lance. They presented well, and I'm very grateful for their courage in front of this audience. So thanks to both.